Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, welcoming you on this beautiful Thursday in Florissant, Missouri. Let me tell you, the weather here has been like fall. Cold, 54 degrees, wet, rainy, and it's like this is almost summer. Memorial Day is just around the corner, and here we're experiencing this horrible weather, and I think it's put everyone in just a really bad mood with all of this weather change. It's like the fall again, and now today it's the total reversal. Well, the old adage is, if you live in Missouri, you know the weather will change. Just stand around and wait for 15 minutes and it's going to change. Well, hopefully it will change for the better and will be consistent. So it's nice out there today. It's beautiful. Spring, summer-like weather, good picnic weather. So glad that you came aboard this morning to join me on The Cross in the Desert. Today, I want to take us on an adventure in film. I love really good movies, and this movie is no exception. It is a movie about Iran. It is the story, the true story of Afshin Ghaffari, a very talented young dancer who, knowing the rules of living in Iran, could not form a dance troupe. It's illegal to dance in Iran. So he formed this underground group to do the dance. And this movie is a true story of his life, his persecution, and his development of the dance. We're talking about the fine arts. We're talking about the cinema. We're talking about the dance. And this morning on The Cross in the Desert, I want to pay tribute to this great man who, despite the obstacles, despite the rules and the oppression of the fine arts, he decided to take the risk. And it's the story of Afshin Ghaffari. And the name of the movie is Desert Dancer. It's been out for a couple of years. I had an opportunity just recently to watch it, and it was a great film. It was very emotional. It was very well done. And I want to introduce you today to this film, the story of Afshin Ghaffari, and the making of Desert Dancer. Here is the trailer. Let's listen right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Dancing class.
Dancing is forbidden. So if you're going to do it, you do it somewhere safe.
Action! Welcome to the Sava.
Our country is like two parallel worlds. There is the one you see outside.
Yes!
And there's this world behind closed doors. In here, we are free.
You know, guys, I've been thinking. I want to start a dance group.
Look, it's illegal.
You get caught, you go to prison.
I want us to take control of our lives. You know, have somewhere that's ours, where we can create with no rules.
An underground dance company. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
So, this is a dance group.
How did you...
Well, if you want to be smart, maybe the last one should take the key with them. Can I audition?
Waving goodbye or raising your fist in the air. But you only make a difference when you find your own secret language.
We should perform to an audience. We can go out to the desert. We can feel what it's like to breathe.
Who is Afshin Ghaffarian?
We will find you, Afshin Ghaffarian!
I'm in a lot of trouble.
You can't stay here, they'll kill you.
Take my passport, it can be fixed. Go to Paris,
and don't come back.
Don't ever get up. Don't let anyone stop you, not even me.
My name is Afshin Ghaffarian. Citizen of Iran. I'm a dancer.
Afshin Ghaffari, a very courageous man who, despite the obstacles, the odds, the risk of his own life, decided it was worth it to form an underground dance group. Let me give you a practical way of understanding the oppression against the fine arts. And this happened a couple of years ago. Will Ferrell, an American artist, rapper, rhythm and blues man, wrote a very popular song called Happy. The song was about, you know, sending in videos and pictures of your happiness and creating a video and celebrating happiness. It was a song about happiness. Well, you can imagine a song like that took a lot of creativity to write, and it was very popular all over the world. And there was a film crew that saw this video and heard this song Happy. They were some young Iranians, and they loved the song Happy so much by Will Ferrell that they decided to make a video of their own. And so these young boys and girls got together, and they had a filmmaker. They went up on top of the rooftops of Tehran and filmed a video to the song Happy. Well, it wasn't very long after it was played on YouTube that, of course, the Iranian regime arrested them and made them publicly apologize on live state TV. Why? Well, there was men and women dancing together in the video. That's not allowed in Iran, and they were without their hijab. That's not allowed in Iran either. They were not dressed properly, showing makeup, not wearing their hijab, men and women dancing together. Well, again, this is the kind of life for young people in Iran. There's no real happiness. They can't do the things they desire to do because of the Islamic restrictions. This film, Desert Dancer, is played on a similar note, if you will. It's the story of having a dream of freedom, of expression, fine arts that is suppressed by Islamic law. And it's the story of one man's courage to stand up against the system for the fine arts, for creativity and dancing, and to take the risk and to say, despite the restrictions, we are going to do this. And he did it. I want to take us now into the film, behind the scenes, the making of the actual choreography, choreographic of the dance itself. And you'll get a little background about Afshin Ghaffari and the movie Desert Dancer. Let's listen right now on The Cross in the Desert.
In Iran, it's in most cases illegal to dance. Desert Dancer is the true story of Afshin Ghaffari, a young man who used dance as a narrative device and as a weapon to fight for freedom. I needed the dancing to be truly unique cinematically.
With Richard, I think the very first thing I said to him was, if I'm going to play this character, I want to be training for a good 6 to 7 months before we start filming.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
For us, none of us being dancers, it was tough.
We were so overjoyed to work with Akram Khan, one of the world's best choreographers. He had this incredible ethereal and spiritual quality to his dance, which I resonated to very strongly.
For me, the only way to experience being a dancer is by being a dancer and living a dancer's life, in a sense. So the intensity that they worked in was incredible.
It was the most challenging thing I've ever done. I really have a newfound, unlimited respect for dancers.
Because we're surrounded by mirrors when we're in a studio, you're tempted to look at yourself and go, oh my God, I look so bad right now, I look so awkward. Just to get out of that self-judgment mode was definitely the prime experience of my entire dance practice.
Akram strives for absolute perfection, which when you're in it, is intensely frustrating because you just want to break, you know. But when he pushes you and pushes you and pushes you, we achieve things that we never believed was possible.
Dance can be anything, waving goodbye or raising your fist in the air.
It was always about discovery in the room. There was no script for the dance, and it was pure creativity.
Well, I put my trust in Akram, so I thought, I'm going to leave the character, I'm just going to move when he tells me to move and explore. And gradually, after like a few weeks or a couple of months, you start to feel, hang on a minute, my body's changed, my posture's changed. Suddenly, this character starts to emerge through movement.
He ends up with immersive, narrative, three-dimensional dance. And it takes you to a very uplifting and inspired emotional place. It's beautiful.
My name is Afshin Ghaffarian. I'm a citizen of Iran. I'm a dancer.
The true story of Afshin Ghaffarian, and what an incredibly courageous man who, despite the odds against him and the risks it would incur, decided to find that freedom in the dance. And not only just find that personal freedom in the dance, but also share that freedom with other Iranians who are thirsty and hungry to express themselves in the creative arts. But because of Islamic law, they were suppressed. Now, his dancing partner, who had a very serious drug problem that he helped her through, was Elahi. And that was played by the actress Frida Pinto. And let's listen to her story of her doing the role of Elahi in the movie Desert Dancer. Here's an interview right now with Frida Pinto on The Cross in the Desert.
Frida Pinto stole our hearts in the Oscar-winning movie Slumdog Millionaire, and she's at it again with her new movie. This one's called Desert Dancer. It's a true story of an Iranian who risks his life to form an underground dance company. And Frida plays one of the members, the only one with any real experience.
Don't worry about your technique. You don't have to think about it.
Of course I do. I mean, you told me that.
Afshin, you can spend your whole life trying to perfect your technique, but you only make a difference when you find your own secret language. That's when you start communicating, connecting.
Frida Pinto, welcome back. Always nice to see you.
Thank you so much. Good to be on the show.
Well, good. We're happy to have you here. I had a chance to see this last night, and my immediate reaction was, this is not one of those roles that you do for the money.
Mm-mm.
This is a role you do because it speaks to you.
Yes. In fact, you do a role like this to lose money on other projects because it took a year of my life to even get ready and prepared for this, for a film like this. So Yeah, it was a whole year of training.
Trying to sum it up is not easy, but it's a story of artistic expression mm-hmm. in the midst of repression, a repressive Iranian regime. Mm-hmm. And the main character in this is a young man who fell in love with dance at an early age and doesn't want to let that dream go.
No, it's true. And, you know, if you look at the global scenario as well, I feel like oppression of expression is really a global subject matter. It's not just restricted to Iran. And that's one of the reasons why I love taking on films like this. I kind of feel like it can be applied different forms of life in different countries as well.
What I love is that a teacher in the movie says to Afshin Ghaffari, and he says, there basically in Iran here, there are two parallel worlds.
Yeah.
One takes place out there on the streets where mm-hmm. there are rules and regulations. The other takes place behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know of this story before you got involved with it?
No, I didn't. And not this particular story. In fact, what I knew about Iran as well was a version of what the news channels give us, or, you know, the media or the internet. So I kind of was living in some sort of oblivion as well, where I really didn't know that dancing is forbidden in one part of the world.
So,
and I come from India. We love dancing. So it was alien subject matter to me.
Have you ever danced on camera like this before? By the way,
no.
I watched you dancing when Flo Rida was just performing in the studio. I did see that. But, I mean, this has got to be a little intimidating.
It is. And it's actually, I think the 1 year of prep really helps you feel a little more confident. But it was very daunting because when we started off, we thought we had 3 months. And then on an indie project like this, you never get funded on time and you keep getting pushed further and further. So it gave me enough time to practice.
What do you want people to walk out of the theaters thinking about after they see this movie?
Well, I think we should really question the subject of expression itself, freedom of expression, going, are we really free to express what we really want to express, or are we forced to do things because a certain regime or a certain group of people want us to put it out that way?
I'd say it's a beautiful...
Start a conversation.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful movie, beautifully
Thank you so much.
Shot and beautifully acted. Frida, it's always good to have you here.
Thank you.
What a pleasure.
Thank you.
And Desert Dancer will be in select theaters this Friday and open nationwide on April 17th.
Well, it goes without saying, I highly recommend that you watch this movie, Desert Dancer. I know this came out a couple of years ago, and it was in select theaters, and one of these theaters was not here. And I was unable to see it, so I had to wait for the DVD release, and it was certainly worth it. Let me tell you a little story. I have an Iranian friend named Romina, and a couple of years ago, she came here. And now she is going to be a citizen, and she is working hard at her career and learning the English language. And Romina is a gifted table tennis player. She is amazing. And to make a long story short, she moved to another location. I won't tell you what city. It's private, and it's something important. We don't need to share that. And she's pursuing her career there. But we begin to correspond back and forth and chat. And she shared with me that she was just thrilled to see this movie, Desert Dancer, how accurate it was. Well, she used to live in Iran, and she understands the culture there, and she understands the oppression by the government. And so you really need to experience this film to see up front how deep the oppression goes. It was filmed at a time when, of course, we were talking nuclear agreements with Iran, and one of the things that's so sad is that the human rights issues were never raised during the nuclear talks at all. But when you meet Afshin Ghaffari in this movie, you will understand his passion for freedom of expression, the fine arts, dancing, and you will learn to appreciate your freedom so much more. During the 2009 presidential election, he was persecuted, he was arrested, he was threatened, and he was able to escape to Paris, France, where he continues to pursue his dancing extravagant career. So I really highly recommend that you take some time out. It's about a two-hour movie, and watch what it's like to live in Iran, to have the thirst and hunger for freedom of expression, and what you have to go through to accomplish the basic freedom and human rights that all of us here enjoy and take so much for granted. So I highly recommend Desert Dancer, and it's been a wonderful experience this morning for me to share this with you, because we talk about human rights, we talk about the horrible things that happen in Iran, but I want you to see it from a different perspective, the very basic freedom of expression that is so oppressed there by this cruel and evil Iranian government. Well, speaking about freedom, I have a great story to share with you this morning, and it touches my heart deeply because it's the story of refugees. And I thank God for this Lutheran pastor in Germany for standing up and being so passionate about reaching out to Iranian refugees. I have a story here that I want to read to you because it's better that I read it than try to just give it lip service. And I want to talk to you today about Germany, and I want to talk to you today about Iranian refugees. My good friend Maral is one of those refugees living in Germany, and she's going through the process, going through the court system and the immigration system to finally one day say, I can become a citizen here in Germany, that I can be given status here, that I can live here. And so I want to read to you this story about a man. His name is Reverend Dr. Gottfried Martens, and he has a real love for Iranian refugees. And I want to read this to you as a tribute to his care and compassion of them. Over the past decade, Germany has seen an unprecedented amount of Iranian and Afghan refugees converting to Christianity. For many of these converts, Reverend Dr. Gottfried Martens has been the pastor who shepherded them through the process. Now, he begins his process of talking to the refugees in a baptism service, and the questions he asks them are, will you break away from Satan and his evil deeds? The pastor asks an Iranian named Mohammed Ali Zunubi, and will you break away from Islam? The candidate answers yes to these and other questions, and, of course, Dr. Martens baptizes him in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Dr. Martens is a pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Berlin, a congregation which has exploded in size due to the dramatic number of Iranian and Afghan converts joining the church. In 2 years, listen to this, the church has grown from 150 members to more than 600, and with more than 500 of those members being Farsi speakers. Prior to joining Trinity Lutheran, Dr. Martin served at St. Mary's Lutheran Church, also in Berlin. Now, Dr. Martin's work among Iranian converts was previously featured, actually 4 years ago, in a Christianity Today article. And at that time, he was named Pastor of the Year by the German magazine there. I want you to hear from his heart, though, what he's saying. These refugees are taking unimaginable risks to live their Christian faith, Dr. Martin said. Imagine, of all places, God chooses Eastern Germany, one of the world's most godless regions, as the stage for a spiritual awakening among Persians. So he's saying, look, these converts, these are new converts to Christianity, are coming here to Germany. I have the privilege of leading them to Christ, of baptizing them, and they're taking their stand in one of the most godless regions, a very difficult region to grow spiritually. Of course, some have questioned the authenticity of these widespread conversions, suggesting a more pragmatic reason for the number of Iranians and Afghans professing faith in Christ. A lot of that is questioned. They have a desire to convert will greatly boost their chances of winning asylum by allowing them to claim they would face persecution if sent home. In other words, there is that suspicion that maybe some of these converts are simply converting to Christianity. Not that they mean it, but it will help them gain a better asylum status if they claim they've become Christians, and they would be persecuted if they're deported back. So there are those that use the system, I'm sure. And you have to understand, of course, that they desire to have freedom, and some of them will use Christianity so that they can stay and gain an asylum status. Well, I want to talk to you about the recent convert of this one Muslim, Zunubi. But for Zunubi and others like him, that threat existed long before they left Iran. Zunubi converted to Christianity as a teenager while still living in Iran and fled to Germany only after Christian friends began to be arrested for their faith. The total number of Christian converts in Iran is difficult to pinpoint, but it is widely understood to be growing. The proselytizing from Muslim to Christian converts in the diaspora, as well as Christian neighbors closer to home, has led to the religion taking hold throughout Iran in numbers previously unseen. Now listen to this. The Guardian's 2014 report suggests the underground nature of the Christian conversion movement has made numbers impossible to determine accurately, but estimates that the Christian population in Iran ranges anywhere from 300,000 to 500,000. That is remarkable. Perhaps some Iranians and Afghans in Germany are joining Trinity Lutheran and other churches merely in an attempt to increase their chances of a successful refugee claim, but Dr. Martens has confidence in God to work through the word and the sacraments. Even then, I know that whoever comes here will not be left unchanged. So he's admitting, that is Dr. Martens, admitting that there are those that use the system, but he's trusting that God will make a change in the lives of those that profess, and perhaps they will really become Christians. And in the case of Mr. Zunubi, he was already a Christian before he left Iran. Yes, there is that taking advantage of the system, and there are going to be those false converts, but the majority of them are very sincere. The majority of them want to have the real freedom to worship Christ without being put to death by living in Iran. So what a man of God this is, Dr. Gottfried Martens, a man I'd love to talk to and interview someday, who has face-to-face experience with Iranian refugees. And it is a pleasure to talk to you about this subject. Please pray for my friend Maral in Germany that her case will go speedily through the courts and that she will be given asylum status and she can stay there in Germany without the fear of being deported back. And I've talked to Maral several times, many, many times over the course of the last three or more years, and she truly does love the Lord. And she did leave Iran because they were going to arrest her because of her Facebook friends, and most of them were Christians. So keep these refugees in prayer. They certainly need our prayers. And don't forget my good friend Paymene as well, who lives in Malaysia, my special lady who I call my goddaughter affectionately. She certainly needs our prayers as well. The refugees of Iran are always on my heart. And I think of them always. Theirs is a difficult situation, a very difficult situation, because sometimes the process takes years. And as we heard a month ago, some refugees are so depressed because of the process that they take their own lives. They find that there's no hope in getting any kind of asylum status. And so these are a breed of people we need to keep in our thoughts and prayers always. It is an honor to speak with you today about Iran. It is an honor to talk about freedom and about the good news of Christ that brings real true freedom to Iranians. And what I want to do now for the next 25 or so minutes, I want to read to you from my book, Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance. And I have an appropriate song to introduce this reading. And this is Shrek. And the next thing you will hear after Shrek is reading chapter 5 of my book, Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance. Thank you. Welcome to a live audiobook reading of my book, Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance. We are continuing our reading in the middle of Chapter 5. Rahane stared down at her cell phone lying in the middle of the bed. She didn't want to answer. She gazed at the clock. It was 11:15 p.m. The loud ringing might wake up her family. Rahane quickly grabbed her cell phone and answered. It was the same voice once again on the other end. "We are standing in front of your apartment," the voice proclaimed. "Come and open the door or we will come in. We are armed." "Who are you?" Rahane shouted back in desperation. "Police," the voice abruptly answered. "Wait, I will be down right away," Rahane promised. As quietly as possible, Rahane ran out of her bedroom door, down the corridor, and around the corner. With trembling hands, she opened the front door. There were three uniformed men standing on the porch. Chief Shamlou, dressed in a white shirt and wearing blue striped pants, pushed open the door. His face was covered in a clean-shaven black beard. He gave Rahane a defiant stare with his penetrating blue eyes. Next to Shamlou was a short, stocky man dressed in a gray pinstripe suit with a gun in his belt holster. He introduced himself as Officer Kamali for Number 10 Shapur Investigation Office. The third man was a tall, slender individual, which Rahane later found out was named Mehrabadi, who served as the official driver of the officer's vehicle. Chief Shamlou proceeded to interrogate Rahane just after walking through the front door. Rahane explained exactly what happened only a few hours earlier. "Where is the knife that you used?" "In my room. Shall I bring it?" Rahane answered. "No. We will come with you," Shamlou replied. Chief Shamlou remained behind while Kamali followed Rahane into her bedroom. Shahzad, Rahane's younger sister, was startled by Kamali entering in through the bedroom door. She sat up in bed, trembling and inquiring what was happening. Kamali stared sharply into Shahzad's eyes, telling her to be quiet. Terrified, Shahzad ducked underneath the covers, overcome with fear and anxiety. Rahane knelt down on the floor and reached underneath the bed to retrieve the knife. She handed the bloodstained knife to Officer Kamali. "What were you wearing at the time of this incident?" Kamali inquired. Rahane walked quickly over to her closet and picked up her clothes. Rahane stared at the blood-stained chador in the hands of Kamali. She turned her head away in horror, unable to once again relive the worst day of her life. Her mind and emotions were exhausted from the unbelievable traumatic events. All that Rahane wanted to do was climb underneath her covers with her sister and pretend that this day had never happened. Suddenly, Sholi appeared in the doorway leading into Rahane's bedroom. She had a shocked expression on her face. "Who are you?" Sholi demanded, perplexed at the presence of a strange man in her home. "Calm down, mother," Rahane reassured Sholi. "What is going on here?" Sholi frantically asked, her face pale with anxiety. "What are you doing in my house?" Officer Kamali opened up his jacket and displayed his gun for Sholi. "Don't show me your gun, sir," Sholi protested in anger. "Who are you?" Just as tempers began to flare with loud voices, Shamlou entered the room to quiet down the commotion. Sholi, overcome with emotion, leaned up against the wall and dropped down on the floor. Shamlou introduced himself and then gave Rahane an angry stare. "Your daughter has hit a pedestrian," and then left the scene. Sholi looked up at Rahane in disbelief. "Rahane, you lied. You didn't say anything about hitting a pedestrian." Sholi then gave Shamlou a desperate look. "Is he dead? Oh, my God," Sholi nervously proclaimed. Shamlou interrupted Sholi. "We can't talk here. Everything will be clarified at the Abbas Abad police station." I will immediately awaken Rahane's father, and we will then leave." "No, Sholi," Shamlou stopped Sholi. "We must first take Rahane with us, and you can join us later." Sholi covered her mouth with her hands in despair. Shamlou then instructed Rahane to immediately leave with them. In a frenzied moment, Rahane didn't stop or say goodbye or kiss her mother, but instead hurriedly covered her hair with a scarf and put on her slippers. She then led the bedroom and walked out the front door in a haste, escorted by Shamlou. It was almost 1:30 a.m. Rahani was now both exhausted and starving. Thinking back, she wished she would have eaten dinner long ago instead of hiding her guilt and shame between the bed sheets. The driver, Mayor Habadi, turned onto the main highway. Rahani leaned her head back up against the seat, trying to relax. Shamlou turned and looked back at Rahani, staring intently into her eyes. "Tell me one more time, what exactly happened?" Rahani was perplexed. She had already explained everything to him just an hour ago. Didn't he believe her story? Taking a frustrated deep breath, she once again explained everything that happened to her, even including the slightest details, mentioning the fact that Dr. Sorbandi had dangled a condom in front of her eyes. Shamlou gave Rahani a look of reassurance. "Yes, we have kept the condom as evidence. This one evidence will save your life. Based on the evidence in Article Number 60, you have legitimately defended yourself, and there is no reason to worry." Rahane breathed a sigh of relief and immediately texted her mother. "Don't worry. It looks like I'll be done by morning. My phone battery is getting low, so I'm turning it off." As Rahane finished texting her mother, Shamlou reached over the seat and grabbed her cell phone. "You are not allowed to use your cell phone." He stuffed her cell phone in his jacket pocket and turned back around in his seat. Arriving at Branch 105, Abbas Abad Police Station, Rahani was escorted through the main lobby and up the stairs into a small room with a conference table and three chairs. As soon as she sat down, Shamlou and Kamali quickly left, shutting the door behind them. Rahani tried to relax in the hard wooden chair. She struggled to stay awake. Her stomach was churning with hunger pains, and to make matters worse, she desperately needed to use the restroom. It seemed like an eternity sitting impatiently waiting for almost an hour until she was once again escorted to another room with a long table and chairs. Rahani squinted her tired eyes and tried to hide them from the bright ceiling fluorescent lights. Seated at the individual chairs were three men, two with black beards and one with dark-rimmed glasses. Once again, Rahani was compelled to explain exactly what happened between her and Dr. Sorbandi. Exhausted, frustrated, and in dire need to relieve herself, Rahani was finally excused from another lengthy interrogation at 6 a.m. in the morning. After the three men finally departed, Shamlou and Kamali stayed behind. To Rahane's surprise, she was allowed to briefly visit with her parents. She was desperate to hug them, but Shamlou prevented her from touching them. "Don't worry, daughter is killed." "Killed?" The word sent shockwaves through Rahane's body. "Sorbandi is dead?" Rahani screamed in shock. Sholi's face turned pale. "Well, was he a drug addict, a drug dealer?" "No, don't worry about it," Shamlou reassured her. "Just come to the inspector's office, number 10, on Shapur Street at 11 a.m. Rahani dropped her head into her hands and leaned forward in her chair. "Dr. Sorbandi is dead," Rahani nervously muttered out loud to herself. "I killed him." She wept. "I will never see my parents, my sister, my home again," Rahani lamented as she buried her face in her hands. It was 6:30 a.m. when Rahani finally arrived at number 10 Shapur Street, where the Inspector 6 office was located. She was weak and exhausted from not sleeping or eating and being subjected to several intense interrogations. As they entered through the front door entrance, Officer Kamali turned toward Rahani as she stood up against the wall, struggling to stay awake and not faint. "Do you know who that man was?" Kamali asked. Breath, her eyelids began to close. She could barely stand up. It was hard for her to concentrate and think. She stared back at Kamali. "Yes, he was a plastic surgeon," Rahane finally answered. Kamali snickered and rolled his eyes. He had a sinister look on his face. "You really don't know anything, do you?" Rahane gave Kamali a perplexed look. Kamali stared intently into Rahane's eyes. "He was a government man, a former intelligence agent." Rahani felt her heart beginning to pound in her chest. She had killed a government man. Suddenly, her case had taken on a whole new dimension. It had become a political case, and she realized the consequences would be devastating for her. A tall, blonde-haired woman veiled in a hijab began to firmly press Rahani's fingers on a piece of paper. She was being fingerprinted. Next, she had to stand up against the wall and hold up a piece of cardboard with a number on it. The humiliation of what was happening began to grip her soul. She suddenly felt like a doomed prisoner, a ward of the state, a prized possession of an angry regime that would surely seek revenge on what she had did. All last evening and all morning, Rahane had protested her innocence at the interrogation. She had acted in self-defense. Dr. Sorbandi had tried to rape her. This had been her adamant plea and desperate claim. As Rahani once again got into the police car, this time, however, she was handcuffed. The cold and tight sensation of steel pressing against her wrists was frightening. Rahane leaned back in her seat, desperately wanting to sleep. The agony of her situation never seemed to come to an end. The police car screeched to a stop at Burzara Detention Center. Rahani was escorted up to the second floor. She noticed a water fountain at the end of the corridor. Her dry mouth was pleading and desperate for a cool sip of water to refresh it. Rahani gazed down at her wrists. How could she possibly push down the button on the water fountain? Kamali escorted Rahani into a brightly lit conference room filled with reporters. Her tired eyes squinted at the bright ceiling lights. She lifted up her cupped hands to try and shield her eyes from the intense lights. Once again, she was forced to repeat her story over and over again. Rahani leaned back in her chair. She was exhausted. Hunger pains shot across her stomach. Her eyelids became heavier and desperate need of sleep. Finally, Shamlou took her by the arm and escorted her down the hallway to a room where a dozen other women were being held. When Rahane walked inside, she could see several other women covered up in soiled and torn blankets that had a foul odor from never being washed in a long time. There were no beds in the tiny, cold, and dark room. Women were sprawled out on the floor, wrapped up in their dirty blankets. One young girl was huddled by herself in the corner, moaning out loud with a sheet wrapped around her body. Several of the other women began coughing and gasping for breath. There was no heat in the dark and dirty room where bodies were crammed together like cattle in a pigsty. Rahane noticed a sink in the corner crammed full of dirty plates and glasses. She could also see two bathrooms and a shower at the very back of the room. "What are you in for?" one young woman asked Rahane as she sat up from sleeping on the floor. "Do you have a cigarette?" she anxiously asked. Rahane didn't answer. She was appalled by the young girl's question. Finding a small space in the corner, Rahane retreated into the dark and squatted down on the cold, hard floor. She wanted to be alone. Tears began to fill her eyes. Shamlou and Kamali had promised her that this would be settled and over by in the morning, and now 24 hours later, Rahane was under arrest and had become a reluctant prisoner in the Burzara Detention Center. Rahane struggled to sleep, even though her mind and body were completely exhausted. During the night, a young girl had screamed so loud that she had to cover her ears. She had gone into convulsions because she was a drug addict. Two guards had to wrestle her to the floor and remove her from the room. After that emotional incident, Rahane had given up on any chance of sleeping. At 6:30 a.m. Tuesday morning, now more than 48 hours after the stabbing incident, two guards entered the room with a tray on wheels to serve breakfast. Each prisoner was allowed a tiny portion of bread and a stick of cheese. Rahane quickly grabbed her portion and gobbled it down. As she finished eating, suddenly a woman who had been sleeping next to her rose up moaning and complaining of being sick. Rahane couldn't believe how cruel the women guards had treated the other prisoners. Once the breakfast time had ended, Rahane laid back down on the floor, trying to get comfortable so she could get some much-needed sleep. Closing her eyes, she began to think about her parents and longed to feel her father's arms around her. The image of her father holding her in his arms brought a warm and relaxing feeling to her soul. Within a few minutes, she felt her heavy eyelids slowly closed as she visualized her father taking her by the hand for the walk in a park. Rahani Jabari. Rahani slowly opened up her eyes. Someone was calling her name over the loudspeaker. Sitting up from the cold, hard floor, she looked around the dark room. The rest of the women were snoring and sound asleep. Rahani clutched the dirty sheet around her body. Her hands were trembling from the cold, damp air in the tiny, cramped room. Her body ached. She could feel every muscle in her body tense up from anxiety. Last night was the first time she had slept on the floor in her life. She longed for her warm and comfortable bed back home. Suddenly, two guards entered the room. Together, they lifted Rahani up from the floor and escorted her to the office, where she was once again handcuffed. "We're taking you to Branch 10," one of the guards sternly told her. Rahani twisted the required scarf around her dirty hair. She hadn't had a shower in 2 days. Walking swiftly in between the two guards, Rahani took a deep breath and wondered how much more she could endure. Both her mind and body were numb from the nightmare that had begun last Saturday. In just a few months, she would celebrate her 20th birthday, and now the question that haunted her was that would she be spending it in a dirty prison as a convicted murderer? Tuesday morning at 10 a.m., Rahani was escorted to Shamlou's office. Waiting outside in the hallway was her mother, Sholi. As soon as she laid her eyes on Rahani, she ran up to give her a hug. "Don't get close," Kamali warned Sholi. Sholi abruptly stopped. Rahani stood completely still, giving Kamali an angry stare. Sholi dropped down on the floor and leaned up against the wall in despair. Rahani noticed the look of horror and worry in her eyes. Rahani sat down at the conference table directly across from Shamlou. Shamlou had a look of frustration in his eyes as he thrummed through his notes on the table in front of him. Then suddenly she stopped and stared directly into her eyes. "Case has become very costly for us. You have to say something else." Shamlou looked down at his notes. Rahani remained quiet and disillusioned. She didn't know what to say. It was now after 1 p.m. in the afternoon. Rahani had been forced to sit on the floor and face the wall. Her body was tired and hurting. Her patience was wearing thin. The psychological techniques that they were abusing her with had taken its toll on her mind. All Rahani wanted was for this nightmare to finally end so she could return home and have a normal life once again. Finally, at 2 p.m., she was summoned back into Shamlou's office. This time, there were two men sitting across the conference table. One man was chubby, short, and well-dressed in a black suit. The other man who joined him was named Colonel Karami. The chubby man sat impatiently in his chair, twirling a pencil in his hand. Finally, he stopped his nervous habit and gazed directly into Rahane's eyes. "Do not play games with us, girl. Tell us the truth." Rahani swallowed nervously and struggled to compose himself. "I have told you the truth." Suddenly, Karami jumped up from his chair and grabbed a hold of Rahane's hair from behind. Rahani flinched in pain as her neck was being stretched backwards. Lifting her out of her chair, Karami dragged her forcefully across the floor, holding tightly onto her hair. Rahani tried to scream but couldn't utter a sound. She tried to break free, but her strength couldn't compare with Kalami's. After a few moments, Kalami laid Rahani's body against the table. She grabbed her head with both of her hands, withering in pain and sobbing. Kamali quickly departed from the loom, leaving the chubby man alone with Rahani. The chubby man ripped up the piece of her that he was writing on. "This is not a joke. If you cooperate, we will inform the judge and he will reduce your sentence. Tomorrow, they are going to arrest your entire family." Rahani bowed her head in pain. She began to tremble as she thought about her family being arrested. Lifting her head back up from her hands, Rahani looked defiantly into the chubby man's eyes. "Believe me, I've told you the truth," Rahani insisted. Karami returned inside the room. Two tall, bearded men were accompanying him. They sat down in the chair, looking down at Rahani and the floor in pain. Karami tightly grabbed a hold of Rahane's arm. "Will you write the truth or not? So far, you have given us nonsense." Wiping the tears from her eye, Rahani stood up and leaned against the table. Her whole body was withering in pain. She wrote exactly what she had written before. Finishing, she handed the piece of paper back to the chubby man. He looked at the piece of paper in disgust and tore it up in anger. With a look of rage in his eyes, he grabbed Rahane's hair and pulled her neck back. One of the tall, bearded men began slapping her face. Rahane screamed in agony as her neck began to be stretched more and more. The bearded man continued slapping her. She began to feel weak. Her legs started to buckle underneath her. She had never been slapped in the face before in her life. The trauma of torture had sapped her strength, and there was nothing left to do now but to collapse. This ends the reading of Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance, the end of Chapter 5. And next time when we meet together, I will begin reading to you Chapter 6. It's entitled Torture. I want to thank you so much for the time that you have spent listening to the reading of this special book. It is the joy and the passion of my life to make every aim to get the story of Rahane Jabari into every media outlet in the world, and that has been my goal. And I just wanted to update you that in just about a week or so, I'll be having a book signing at Family Christian Bookstore, where I'm employed. And for the last 6 years, I've had the opportunity to have book signings there. It's going to be very special. I'm looking forward to it. I'm doing it a little bit different than the usual. I'm going to display some extra pictures of Rahane and the book, and I'm looking forward to this because I'm supposed to be receiving in the mail very soon the DVD of the documentary Rahane, The Beautiful Fragrance, that was put together and produced by Sahar, and she is a television producer in Los Angeles with Ulfagaran TV. And in the last couple of weeks, they've been busy putting the subtitles on this DVD because it's all in Persian. And they've been putting English subtitles on it, and they are supposed to send that to me. And that will be the perfect capstone to the book signing, to have the actual documentary there at the book signing. I'm looking forward to that because it was well produced. It also had an interview with Sholeh, Rahane's mother, on it. And so I really want my customers to be able to get the best out of this book signing by actually taking the time to watch this documentary. Even though it's English subtitle, it will still have, I think, a very powerful effect. And it is telling Rahane's story. It's making people aware of what's going on in Iran while we sit making nuclear deals with them. It's really just unbelievable that we would sit down with an evil, cruel regime that treats their people this way. And that's why I'm so determined to get Rahane's story out in every available media outlet. And I want to thank you so much for tolerating this. We're only going in Chapter 6, and we have 6 more long chapters. And believe it or not, we'll be finished with the book. But what I want to do now, I want to transition this morning, and I want to introduce to you a band that is phenomenal. They've been around quite a long time, and on the sound check this morning, we're going to be featuring the music of Third Day. They're a Christian rock band. They were formed in Marietta, Georgia in the 1990s. It was founded by lead singer Mac Powell and guitarist Mark Lee, and at that time, the member Billy Wilkins. Their name is very obviously a reference to Jesus rising from the dead on the third day after his crucifixion, thus the title, Third Day. They were inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame back in September of 2009. They have sold over 7 million albums in the U.S. They've had 28 number one hits. They are a phenomenal band. Actually, they had a bit of a musical change in their style, and it's just amazing. They've been around for about 24, 25 years. Mac Powell and Mark Lee formed the band Third Day when they were high schoolers. And so they have been playing the circuit now for a very, very long time. And they have some phenomenal songs. And so today, on the soundcheck, we'll be featuring the music of Third Day. Welcome to the Sound Check, here where I feature the best in contemporary Christian music. And today is no exception. It's the phenomenal music of Third Day. And the first song we're going to hear is one of their early songs they wrote, and it was immediately well received. It's called Consuming Fire, referring to the nature of God. Our God is a consuming fire. I want to share a few of the lyrics with you. Set this place on fire. Send your spirit, Savior. Rescue from the mire. Show your servant favor. And yes, our God, he is a consuming fire, and the flames burn deep in my soul. Yes, our God, he's a consuming fire. He reaches inside and he melts down this cold heart of stone. Let's listen this morning to the incredible Christian music of Third Day.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We'll be right back.
The music of Third Day tonight, today on the soundcheck, a song called Consuming Fire. Just taking a few moments to reflect on that song, I want you to think of the fact that fire is purifying. And the Bible talks about fire in several different ways. One way is judgment. And the book of Hebrews says very directly, it is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. And the Bible also says that he is a consuming fire. That is, he purifies us. And so we think of fire in one sense as judgment and another sense as purification. And for the Christian, that sometimes our hearts become hardened. It is the consuming fire of the Holy Spirit that breaks the stone of hardness and purifies us. And this is a great illustration that we as Christians can relate to. We want our lives to reflect God's holiness. We want our lives to reflect his purity. And that is the work of the Spirit, that purification process. And sometimes our heart is overgrown with weeds. And you think of the illustration of someone pulling weeds out of the garden. It's something that we do by the power of his Spirit to pull those weeds out of the garden of our heart so that our heart is pure. And one of the works of the Holy Spirit is the purifying work of his fire. And we talk a lot about God's fire coming down from heaven. We see in the Old Testament, Elijah called down fire from heaven, and that was an act of judgment upon the false prophets of Baal. But there's also that work, that behind-the-scenes work, if you will, of the work of the Spirit, that consuming fire that he purifies the things in our lives to conform us more to the image of Christ. About 8 years ago, there was a personnel change and an album change, a producer change with Third Day. And they produced an album called Revelation. It was their ninth studio album. It was released back in July of 2008. It was produced by a man named Howard Benson. He had never worked with Third Day before. But this album, it was amazing how well it did. Third Day continues to say that this is their best album. It sold over 75,000 copies in the first week, and there were four singles that were played on the radio station. It was certified gold by the recording industry, shipping over 500,000 copies. But we're not talking all about achievements here. It's about ability. It's about content. And so this album has a rock, a southern rock, kind of a Christian rock edge to it. And we're going to hear one of the songs on there that you will probably relate to. It's a song called Revelation, and it's the title track from Third Day's ninth studio album. Let's listen to it right now on the cross in the desert.
My life is leading me down the road that's so uncertain. Now I am left alone and I am broken, trying to find my way, trying to find the faith that's gone. This time I know that you are holding all the answers, but I'm tired of losing hope and taking chances never seem to be the ones that bring.
I'm
Music of Third Day on the soundcheck this morning, a song called Revelation. We're going to continue on with perhaps one of the most well-known songs by Third Day, and it's a song of praise. When you look at the universe, you see the intricacy of the universe, the beauty, and you begin to think of a God, a creator, who fashioned it and put it all together. A beautiful sight, like in Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. And so this is a song quite familiar to most of us that do worship. It's called God of Wonders. Some of the lyrics are, God of wonders beyond our galaxy, you are holy, holy. The universe declares your majesty, and you are holy. Lord of heaven and earth. Let's listen to Third Day once again, and here is God of Wonders.
To the Lord of
That is Third Date Live with one of their most recognized beautiful praise songs. It's called God of Wonders. Well, this last song, I say for last purposely, this is probably one of their best songs. It's an incredible song of hope when you're in a hopeless situation. And, of course, I'm speaking about Cry Out to Jesus. I want you to hear some of the lyrics because I want you to think about this when you listen to this song. If you're hurting, if you're really in a hopeless situation, then as Third Day says, cry out to Jesus. To everyone who's lost someone they love long before it was their time, you feel like the days you had were not enough when you said goodbye. And to all of the people with burdens and pains keeping you back from your life, you believe that there's nothing and that there is no one who can make it right. There is hope for the helpless, rest for the weary, love for the broken heart. There is grace and forgiveness, mercy and healing. He'll meet you wherever you are. Cry out to Jesus. Cry out to Jesus. This is Third Day.
Thank you.
Cry Out to Jesus, the incredible Christian music of Third Day we've been featuring this morning on the sound check. And God desires to hear the cries of your heart, and He is faithful to answer them. When we think about crying out to Jesus, when we think about the music we've listened to this morning by Third Day, and especially God of Wonders, it brings me to an incredible portion of Scripture, Isaiah chapter 40, which is God displaying His greatness. His covenant people had somehow, in the hardness of their heart, resorted to consulting idols. And Isaiah chapter 40 is a rebuke by God to them for even considering that idols can do anything to help them. And before we become, you know, a little harsh and judgmental, think about our culture. We're obsessed with the unknown and the mysterious. And there is a God in heaven who loves us and wants us to trust in His greatness. But our culture consults idols today. It's not anything new. From psychics to astrologers to mediums to soothsayers, instead of the great God in heaven who loves them infinitely with an irresistible love. Why? Why? Well, it's the hardness of our heart. It's the blindness of our eyes. It's the sin of unbelief. And God in Isaiah chapter 40 asks this question: to whom will you compare me? Who is my equal? And then He asks them to look at the heavens. He says, look up into the heavens. Who created all the stars? He brings them out like an army, one after another, calling each by its name. Because of His great power and incomparable strength, not a single one is missing. And so He's chiding His people for looking to anything or anyone but Him for wisdom and strength, salvation, security. And then God ends chapter 40. It's an interesting chapter. We have God speaking at one point and then Isaiah speaking at another point. And Isaiah asks the rhetorical question to His people: have you ever heard, have you never understood? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of all the earth. He gives, and I love the way that He describes this. The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of all the earth. He never grows weak or weary. No one can measure the depths of His understanding. He gives power to the weak, powerless. Even youths will become weak and tired, and young men will fall in exhaustion. But those who trust in the Lord will find new strength. They will soar high on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint. In the bookstore where I work, I can't tell you how many plaques have this particular quote of Scripture engraven on them. Why? Because it's so powerful and it's so true. In Isaiah chapter 40, God has been rebuking His people for even trusting in idols. And at the end of this chapter, God reveals His strength for the weary. He is the creator. He calls out the stars by name. He is great. It's the greatness of God. So why, Israel, would you look to false idols who can't speak, who can't give hope, who can't give strength? And God says, if you trust in me, you're going to find new strength. You're going to soar high on wings like eagles. You're going to run. You're never going to grow weary. You're going to walk and not faint. God gives us spiritual energy and strength in every situation because He's great, because He's powerful, but also because He's loving. He cares for us individually. Jesus said, that he cares more about us than the very sparrows that he feeds daily. You are more worthy to him than even a sparrow that he takes care of on a daily basis. You have infinite value to our great God and Savior. And today, if you feel hopeless, like you have no strength and no energy to go forward and to go on, God says, come to me. Jesus says, come to me, you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. He will give you new strength. He promises this new strength will give you incredible energy to fly like the eagle. You'll run and not grow weary. You're going to have hope again. You're going to have strength again, because God will give you that hope and strength in him, trusting in him. And so today, the promise of God is for you. No matter what has happened in your life, God knows your trial. He knows your situation. And he has a promise for you. If you're hopeless, you can find hope. If you're without energy and strength, you can find strength and energy. And he will give that to you because he loves you, because he cares for you individually. And so today, know that the promise of God is for you, and to reach out in faith and receive it and claim it for your life today. I want to thank everyone in the chat room today. I want to thank you, Patricia, once again for being so supportive and coming in and listening to the program. God bless you immensely for all of your time and for all of the sharing that you do about my dear Iranian friends. I want to thank you, the listener. I pray that you have an incredible weekend, and I will see you next Monday on the Cross in the Desert.
Great of wrath our souls.